Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And if you'd like to be a participant on the program, I have a phone number for you that's toll-free, and you can call if you have a question about anything related to the Bible or Christianity or your own spiritual life and journey, or if you have a disagreement with the host and would like to call and champion another viewpoint, I'd be glad to have you call in and do that. We have a couple lines open right now. You can call at 1-800-438-5090. Now, of course, this Friday is Christmas Day, and I will not be broadcasting on Christmas Day. Not because I wouldn't, but because for me to broadcast requires that KKMC has actually someone in the studio to screen calls and things like that, and I'm not going to do that to somebody else. To me, even if I'm celebrating Christmas, I can take an hour out to do the show, but I don't want to have someone leave their family and go into the studio, because I do it from my home. Anyway, so we're going to play a recorded program, probably one you've already heard on Christmas, but you probably won't be listening anyway. But that means we have four days this week for you to call in and get through, and today is one of those days. We are live. The number 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Mark, calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I got a question about. It's actually about Mark 7.
Uh huh.
It says in Mark 7, starting in 24, it talks about this Greek lady who had a demon possessed daughter.
Yep.
And in 7:27, Jesus said, "Let the little children be filled first, for it is not good to take the children's." And then she says in 28, and she answered and said to him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs under the table eat from the children's crumbs."
Right.
And then Jesus said to her, and I got to hang up. I just want to ask, and I'm going to listen to what you say, but I have to get off the phone. But and Jesus says, "For this saying, go your way, the demon has gone out of your daughter." What is it about what she said that made him say that?
Oh, okay. Well, I think over in Matthew's parallel, which is in Matthew 15, I think he says, "Oh, woman, great is your faith." I think her statement reflected her faith. But if her statement is confusing, I'll be glad to discuss it.
Yeah, I don't understand it.
Okay.
But I got to hang up. Thanks, Steve.
All right, Mark. Thanks for your call.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. Well, this story is about a woman who is not Jewish. In Matthew, I think she's called a Syrophoenician woman. I believe Mark calls her a Greek woman, if I'm not mistaken. But she had a demon-possessed daughter who was not with her. She had left her daughter at home and come to seek Christ's help in driving the demon out of her daughter. And Jesus initially ignored her somewhat rudely. Actually, Christians, when they read these stories, sometimes this particular story, sometimes they're a bit offended by Jesus' seeming callousness, because he just kept walking with his disciples, and she was begging him alongside the road, following along, trying to get his attention, and he wasn't speaking to her or giving her attention. And the disciples finally came up to him and said, "Lord, send her away. She keeps annoying us." And Jesus then spoke apparently to the disciples, but apparently within her hearing so that she could answer what he said. He said, "It's not right to take the children's food and give it to the dogs." Now, what he was alluding to was the fact that what he had come to do was to provide something for Israel. They were the children of the covenant. They were the persons that he came to reach. There are, he actually even said, I believe earlier in the same conversation, he said, "I am not sent but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." He is, he's saying that he's not at this point really planning to reach out to the Gentiles. Now, we know that at a later point he was going to do so. It must have been just a matter of timing. At this point in his ministry, he felt he needed to reach Israel. And then, after they were reached, the Gentiles could. So he was kind of ignoring this Gentile woman. And he said, "It's not good for me to take the children's food and give it to the dogs." He was referring to the Gentiles as dogs. That's the way the Jews actually did view the Gentiles, as dogs. Unclean people, because they were uncircumcised and didn't keep the law, and dogs were an unclean animal. So the Jews commonly referred to the Gentiles as dogs, and Jesus was using a common expression, but creating a household image of, you know, you've got children in the house and you've got dogs in the house. God in his world has his children, the Jews, at that time. I don't believe that the Jews are particularly set apart to be God's children in our time, but they were certainly the children of the covenant at that time. And then there were the Gentiles. He said, I came to bring food for the kids, not for the dogs. Now, the woman was not rebuffed by this. Now, sometimes Christians reading it are more offended by Jesus' words than she apparently was, because she said, that's right, Lord, but even the dogs get the crumbs that fall from the children's table. And she simply accepted the idea that she, as a Gentile, was viewed by Jews as a dog, and she didn't seem to object to that. She just said, well, even dogs, you know, the master cares for the dogs, too. What the children don't eat, he'll give to the dogs. And, you know, she may have been implying that the master has enough bounty that he can feed his children and have some left over for the dogs, too. Or she might have been implying that the Jews were not receiving the food. The kids were throwing the food on the table, off the table, onto the floor, and the dogs are entitled to that. I'm not sure which she implied, because both would have been true. It was true that the Jews in general were not receiving Jesus at that time and what he had to offer. Some were, but the leaders were not. And she might have perceived that and said, well, you know, if the kids don't want it, can the dogs have it? That's general policy in a household. And so, you know, she was recognizing the truth of his statement, but still continuing to express faith that she could, despite his cold shoulder he was giving her, that he could still and help her daughter. And then he said, oh, woman, great is your faith. Now, I'm not looking at the passage in Mark here, but I believe, let me see if I can find it here. Okay, yeah, in Mark he doesn't say great is your faith. I believe it's in the parallel in Matthew, which is Matthew 15. Let me see if I can find this real quickly. Okay, this is a long chapter. It's Matthew 15:28. Jesus answered and said to her, O woman, great is your faith. Let it be as you desire. Now, our caller was asking, why did her daughter get healed? And because Jesus had just said, for this saying, go your way, the demon has gone out of your daughter. That's what it says in Mark. In Matthew, it's worded differently. He said, because of your faith. The woman's words were seen as an expression of her faith, and that's what Jesus was marveling at. Jesus often marveled at the faith of Gentiles because he saw not as much faith as he hoped to find in the people of Israel. You might remember that when he spoke in Nazareth, it says that he could do no mighty works there. That was his hometown. He said he could do no mighty works there, and he marveled at their lack of faith. Yet on this occasion and also on another, in Matthew 8, when there was a Gentile centurion who came to him, Jesus, it says, he marveled at the man's faith and said, I've not seen this kind of faith in all Israel. So what this story tells us is that even though Jesus was primarily interested in helping Jews at this point in time, rather than, you know, expanding his outreach to the Gentiles, a Gentile who had exceptional faith could still get something from him. And that was true, of course, even in the Old Testament, when Israel was God's chosen people and the Gentiles were not. Yet there were Gentiles like Naaman the Syrian, who had leprosy, and because of his faith, God healed his leprosy. And the widow of Zarephath, who was a Syrian woman, who Elijah fed her for 3.5 years during the famine, actually miraculously, even though some of the Jewish widows went hungry. So one of the lessons of the Bible is that although God has his covenant people, which was Israel in the Old Testament, yet even those who did not have that covenant relationship could prevail with God if they had faith, because God honors faith no matter who that's coming from. Let's talk to Jacob from Houston, Texas next. Hi, Jacob. Good to hear from you.
Hey. Hi, Steve. It's been a while, brother. How are you?
Yeah, it's good. I thought you'd moved to India or something.
No, not yet. But
you are planning to, aren't you?
Steve, my question today is, truth be told, this is come up. I've been doing some searching on it in the last a few weeks, and yep, it's truly a source of confusion to me now. Partly, I guess, because I've not done any study or read up any heard any of your tapes on this issue. But can you please address this issue of preterism, and more specifically, the issue of partial preterism versus full preterism? Now, I have been to a website called preterist.org of late, and it appears that...
And they're full preterists, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, full preterists, right. Now, the reason I mention it is it appears that they are folks who have done some amount of research. There's a gentleman there by the name of Don Preston. I don't know if you've heard of him.
I have, yes.
Okay. Now, my question is, it appears that there are other brothers who are throwing the heresy word out there. You know, I was wondering if you can shed some light on this debate, also on that charge of heresy. And is it possible that in the months to come, I mean, have you ever debated one of a person? I know that you're a partial preterist, but have you ever debated a person on the full preterist side?
Not in a public debate, no.
Okay.
There's been a little bit of back and forth on that subject at our web forum. Well, Jacob, let me. Now, you usually just want to listen on the air. Do you want to stay on the line?
Hey, I'd stay on the line on this one, please, if you don't mind.
Okay, good. Well, please do. Just for the sake of our listeners who don't know the vocabulary, you're asking about the difference between partial preterism and full preterism, and a lot of people don't know what preterism is, so I'll just make this point that.
Definitely.
When it comes to interpreting certain prophecies, especially books like the Book of Revelation, there are different approaches people take, and the most popular approach today is the futurist approach, which is the view that the Book of Revelation has a fulfillment to be looked forward to in the future, where preterism is the view that it has a past fulfillment. And most preterists believe that the Book of Revelation was fulfilled when Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. And so they don't see it as a future end of the world kind of a book at all. They see it as a book about prophecies that were after the time of they were written, but long before our own time, they were fulfilled. Now, preterists, whether partial or otherwise, don't only apply that to the Book of Revelation, but apply that to many prophecies of the Bible, which are more popularly applied to the end of the world in the second coming of Christ. That is to say, things like Matthew 24 and a lot of the passages in the Old Testament, which popular teachers apply them to the end of the world, preterists consider that many of these are fulfilled back in AD 70. So that's what a preterist is. The word preterist comes from the Latin word preter, which means past. And preterist means one who believes the fulfillment is in the past. Now, a partial preterist, like myself, believes that some of these prophecies, which are popularly applied to the end of the world, are not actually about the end of the world, but are about AD 70. But a partial preterist also believes that there is a future second coming of Christ, and that there are some passages in the Bible that make reference to it. The difference between a partial preterist and a full preterist is that a full preterist believes that all prophecies have been fulfilled by AD 70, and that there are no future prophecies to be fulfilled. There is no second coming of Christ. There is no resurrection of the dead. There is no end of the world. But that the world will go on eternally, and each generation will just live and die and, you know, go through their own testing and get saved or not get saved and go to heaven or hell and whatever. And that's what a full preterist believes. Now, I'm not a full preterist, and I don't believe that that's correct doctrine. Now, you asked about the label of heresy being given to that. It's very common to hear full preterists called heretics. But then it's way too common to hear people called heretics who simply disagree with the speaker, whoever the speaker may be and whatever they may believe. Christians throw the word heretic around much too easily, I think. Originally, at least in the early centuries of the church, the word heretic referred to somebody who did not believe in the creeds. Once they started having these various creeds developed of the official Christian doctrine, if a person didn't believe what was in the creeds, they were considered to be heterodox or heretical.
Right.
Now, yeah.
With respect to, you know, the you know, what would you see is perhaps some of your most compelling thoughts or arguments for a partial preterist view? I was just wondering if anything comes to your mind as to, you know, what you feel is most strongly suggests that, you know, that the partial preterist view is the correct view.
Well, the reason I don't believe in full preterism is because there are many references in the Bible to a resurrection at the last day, a resurrection of the dead, when all the graves will be emptied and all the dead will come out and come back to life. Now, the full preterist believes that even those prophecies have been fulfilled. though different, I've read and talked to different preterists who have different views on this, and I don't think they have strong position. They either believe that there really was a physical resurrection of the dead and a physical rapture of the church in A.D. 70, but it simply went unrecorded in history, and all the Christians were caught up out of the graves and off the face of the earth into heaven. I've actually heard some full preterists suggest this, which to my mind, I hate to say it, it sounds ridiculous to me. I mean, how in the world could there have been every Christian on the planet removed in AD 70, and then the church got started again from scratch and grew as it did in the second and third centuries? It just doesn't make sense to me. And why it would be that the second generation of Christians wouldn't remember or mention that such a radical thing had happened. To me, that's a wild conception. The other view that some full preterists take about that is that the resurrection and rapture are to be spiritually understood, and they don't refer to a physical resurrection at all. I don't think that makes a lot of sense either, because Jesus said all that are in the graves will hear his voice. Well, that's physical bodies are in the graves. Yeah, it's also true that there's such a thing as coming to life spiritually. For example, when you're born again, the Bible speaks about you passing from death into life, spiritual death into spiritual life. But the resurrection is always spoken of as the graves being emptied and, you know, the bodies coming out. So to make that a spiritual resurrection seems really strange to me. And it's even stranger to suggest that there was a physical resurrection of all the dead, you know, in AD 70, but just no one ever mentioned it in history. That's pretty wild.
Got it. Right. Okay. So, Steve, thank you. Do you have other callers on the line, Steve?
I do, but did you have another question?
Oh, no. I'm off this week, so I'm going to call in again tomorrow.
Great. It'll be good to hear from you again.
All right. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Jacob.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Kyle from Portland, Oregon. And I have line open for you also if you'd like to call me. It's 1-800-438-5090. My name is Steve Gregg. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you have questions about the Bible or disagree with the host and want a balanced comment, feel free to call me right now. 1-800-438-5090. Kyle, good to hear from you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I guess I kind of wanted to start out with a little confession and then maybe get your opinion slash advice. I would consider myself a pretty strong believer in Jesus, and I love studying the Bible. And the one area that I really feel that is lacking in my walk with God is my prayer life. And I haven't studied the concept or the idea of prayer and how we should pray, so I know that's my next step, but I figured I'd just call and chat with you. But kind of one of my thoughts on why I struggle in this area, I find my prayers to be very repetitive, and the reason I think they are is because I so strongly believe that God has everything under control, that he is essentially, his will is going to be done. So my prayers are essentially, you know, I pray for this, but I pray your will would be done. Then I pray for this, and I pray your will would be done. And it really struck me recently when a friend of mine's father got cancer, and he asked me to pray for him, and I said, well, surely I will. And as I pray for my friend's father, I pray that God would heal him, but then I always have to right afterwards pray, but your will be done. And I don't know. I think maybe somewhere in the back of my mind that's kind of caused me to limit my prayer, knowing that God's will is always going to be done, if that makes sense.
Well, first of all, about being embarrassed about your prayer life, join the club. You know, C.H. Spurgeon said, if you want to embarrass any Christian man, just ask him about his prayer life, because almost everybody feels that they should be more potent in their prayers than they are, or more faithful about them. I mean, almost everyone prays sometimes, whether they're Christians or not, but Christians really believe that prayer is supposed to move the hand of God and change the world and so forth, and you know, we should be about it much more than the average person, of course. We're the ones who really believe it can do something, but most Christians don't pray very much, and I think it's, or they don't pray as much as they feel they should, and one of the reasons is what you say. They feel that their prayers are repetitive. There's certain leading concerns that are burdens on people's hearts. You know, they pray for their parents who are ailing, or their children who are straying, or for something else, their finances that are on the rocks. And they pray for things because these are dominant things in their minds. And when they pray, these things come to mind, but nothing else does. You know, you pray for the thing that you feel desperate about, and then after you've done that, you're kind of there with a blank mind, and you start thinking about what's on TV tonight and when you're supposed to be praying. I think the problem we have is that we don't understand what prayer is for. We think it's just, you know, when you get desperate enough and don't have anywhere else to turn, you need to turn to God and give him your wish list, sort of like giving Santa Claus your wish list. And hopefully, you know, he'll take it. Now, you've got another aspect to your prayer concerns there, and that is you believe that God's will is always done. I don't necessarily believe that God's will is always done. I believe that our prayers actually do change things, and that some things that we pray for will be done because we prayed for them, and if we had not prayed for them, they wouldn't be. Remember, James says, "You do not have because you do not ask."
Mm-hmm.
Remember that line?
Yeah.
Well, if you do not have because you do not ask, if that's really why you don't have, it means that you would have if you had asked, and that praying would have made a difference. And that suggests that there are things that God would give you if you asked, but you didn't ask, so he didn't. And if he would give you those, if you asked, they must have been his will. And he may be disappointed that we haven't asked. I think that's what James is suggesting. So I don't think that God's will is always done. Now, are you something of a Calvinistic in your theology?
I don't really know what that means, so I can't answer that.
Well, the Calvinists have what they would call a high view of the sovereignty of God, which is really a belief in what I would call just God controlling every little detail that goes on, and nothing goes on, nothing happens apart from him making it happen. Some people believe that that's how God runs the universe, and I personally don't think that. I believe that God has delegated some of the running of the world to people. When he made Adam and Eve in his image, he told them to have dominion over the world and manage it. And I believe he gave them some freedom to set some of the direction. In fact, I think that seems obvious since they sinned. I don't think he wanted them to sin. He told them not to. He told them not to, and they did. So it's clear that he gave them some freedom to make their own choices. And because people have freedom to make their own choices, I think they sometimes don't choose what God would want. Now, I don't believe that God is impotent in the situation, because I believe that God can work things around. God can work all things, or maneuver all things. The way I see it, it's a little bit like a chess master who never loses a game, and he can play, you know, 60 games at the same time with amateurs and win them all. Now, he doesn't know what they're going to do. He doesn't have to. He can beat them no matter what they do. You know, he's smart enough that no matter what move the amateurs make, he can still counter it and get, you know, the checkmate that he wants. And I feel that it's that way with God. God is not making everything happen, but he will still make his ends come true. I sometimes have compared it also with, a cruise ship. The captain is the one who determines where the ship goes. The passenger may determine whether he's going to play shuffleboard or lay by the pool or go into the bar. You know, the passenger has the right to make some decisions of his own, but he's not going to change the direction of the ship. The captain does that. And I believe that God is directing the course of history. But within the course of history, he gives us individual choices which have more or less effect on our happiness and our well-being, and maybe even on some other people's happiness and well-being. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't change the outcome that God's going to bring out in the final end of where the world is going in his plan. So
right.
I believe God's overall will is done, but I believe that individual smaller issues are left to us, including our own destiny, I believe, in a sense that whether we believe in him or not, I believe he even leaves that up to us, and that's why he's disappointed when we don't. You know? So,
yeah.
But there are people who think God controls all of those things. It's called, I refer to it as meticulous providence. You know, the view that God meticulously causes everything to happen is a Calvinistic view. I don't hold that view myself.
Yeah, that's helpful. Do you that James passage is a really good one. Do you have any other passages that come to mind that kind of go along with this viewpoint? Or
well, when the disciples were unable to cast a demon out in Matthew chapter 17, they said, "Why couldn't we cast it out?" And Jesus said, "Because of your lack of faith." Now, he didn't say because you didn't pray, but it's sort of the same kind of thing. You know, if you pray with faith, things get done. And Jesus actually did cast the demon out where the disciples failed. So it's clear that God wanted that demon out, and Jesus pulled it off. The disciples failed to pull it off because of their lack of faith or because of their unbelief. So I believe that our prayers and our faith are, you know, effectual in making things happen. James also says that the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much.
Right.
There's plenty. Jesus said, whatever you ask in my name, I will do it. So he's making it sound like if you ask, he's going to do it. He doesn't make any promise that he'll do it if you don't. So prayer is actually not just sort of a therapeutic thing that Christians are told to do to calm them down, sort of like transcendental meditation or something. Prayer is actually a means of engaging God in the events of the world. And that's why, you know, when Jesus said we should pray, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, why should we pray that unless it's not automatic? You know, if he's going if his will is going to be done whether we ask or not, then why does he tell us to pray for it?
That's a good point, too. Yeah. Boy, when you explain it, it really sounds very simple and very clear. I really appreciate that. That's huge. I'm definitely going to do a more thorough study and really dig into this point here more.
Well, you know, when we pray, we really should be thinking that we are engaged in important work. God has sort of delegated to us some of the privilege of ruling the world and changing history, not only by our prayers. Of course, we do that by our actions as well, by our voting and by our actions and the choices we make. But our prayers are one of the ways that we do so. I consider that our work and our prayer are two ways that God has empowered us to have a causative effect on the way things go. And what we can do, we should do. And what we can't do, we pray that God will do. So our work does the part that we can, and our prayers seek God to do the part that we can't do. But in both cases, God is giving us sort of the dignity of causation.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I really appreciate that.
Okay, Kyle, I hope that helps.
Great. Have a good day.
Good talking to you. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, we're going to talk next to Bruce from Las Vegas. And once again, we have a line open for you. And we have time to take your call, too. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. If you want to call with any question about the Bible or your Christian life or anything like that, feel free to call me at 1-800-438-5090. That's 438-5090. Bruce from Las Vegas, good to hear from you again.
Good. Thanks for having me on today, Steve. Matthew 27, let's see, 52 and 53, but when Jesus...
When the graves were opened, when Jesus came out of the grave, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when he gave up the spirit, and the, I'm in the NIV, so...
There was an earthquake.
James. Yeah, an earthquake, and the rock split, and then in 52, the tombs broke open, and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life.
Right.
And then after Jesus' resurrection, they appeared to many people. Were they in physical bodies or glorified bodies?
I think they were in ordinary bodies, but we have to kind of come to a decision about who these many saints were. When we think of saints, we may be thinking of people like the Catholic saints, who are people who lived hundreds of years ago and who've been dead for a long time. But the word saints just means a holy person. And in my opinion, the many who came out of their tombs when Jesus rose were not the saints of the Old Testament. I don't think Isaiah and David and Moses came out. For one thing, they were well decomposed. They had been dust for many years. And if they did walk into Jerusalem, no one would recognize them because no one living had ever seen them or knew what they looked like. There had been no portraits or photographs of them. So, I mean, it would be impossible to identify them if they were people who lived hundreds of years earlier. My impression is that these are people who had died recently. People like Lazarus, you know, Lazarus didn't come out at that time because Jesus gave him a private raising. But I think people like that, people who were godly people who had died in, you know, recent memory. And when Jesus rose, some of them were given the ability to come back to life and rejoin their families and be seen by people who knew them. And that was a sign to Jerusalem that something had happened, because Jesus didn't show himself after he rose from the dead to anyone but his disciples.
Right.
Only one man, other than his disciples, got to see him after he rose from the dead, and that was his own brother, James. But
they couldn't even recognize him.
Yeah, that's right. So I always wonder why Jesus didn't appear to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin and those people who condemned him and Pilate. But he just wasn't into rubbing it in their faces, apparently. He had something to communicate to his disciples, so he appeared on several occasions to them.
It was about love and being humble. He didn't have a vendetta.
Yeah, so actually I think these other people who came out of the graves did so sort of like when Lazarus did, as a sign of who Jesus was, because the people who didn't see Jesus after he rose could nonetheless see someone else who came out of the grave, and they would make the impression that wanted to make, I think.
Oh, yeah, that must have been truly amazing, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It says many holy people, so it had to have been quite a few people. I mean, these people saw these people that just passed away come back to life.
Yeah.
It just must have been an amazing...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what many. I don't know what many means. Many could mean hundreds, or it could mean dozens. You know.
Yeah.
But it still would be amazing to see anyone come out of the grave.
All right, that was pretty interesting because I was just curious whether they had a glorified body or a physical body. But physical body makes sense.
I'll give you a reason why I don't think they had a glorious body, because Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 says that everyone will rise from the dead, but he says each in his own turn. He said Christ the first fruits, and afterward those who are his at his coming. So Paul's giving the order of people who will be glorified. Jesus was first, and the next group will be those who are his at his coming, and this other group would be sort of in between there. And I don't think they experienced a glorification of their bodies like Jesus did, and like we will when Jesus returns. I think they simply were reanimated. Their breath came back into them, and it's sort of like you hear about happening in hospitals once in a while, even now. But this is probably more miraculous. I imagine they've been dead for days, if not weeks.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you, Steve. You covered a good one there. And,
okay, Bruce.
Have a great day.
Hey, you have a good day, too.
Okay.
Good talking to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is David calling from Watsonville. Once again, we have a line. I just got to keep giving this number out until all these lines are full. If you want to give me a call, it's 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. David, good to hear from you.
Hi, how you doing today?
All right.
Good. I just had a quick comment on the gentleman that called a few minutes ago on wanting to know more about prayer and stuff.
Yeah.
One thing that I had a couple of pastors recommend to me and has really helped out is referencing a lot of the Psalms with David, because David was very well known as the man after God's own heart.
Yep.
And a lot of times today, it's very easy for us to get into the habit of, like you mentioned, making it a grocery list and saying, God this, God that, God this, God that. But David more pushed toward an intimate relationship, kind of like... you being married to a very special lady, you can't get enough of wanting to know more how she feels, wanting to know more about how she thinks and what she likes and what she dislikes and stuff, and you want to know every intimate detail about her, and you try to communicate and spend more time with her. And I think that's probably what David did in the Old Testament, where he was a man of war, and he didn't get the privilege of actually building the temple. But he did know how to get in touch with God, and he did know how to open up things to where God would move, and God did bless and take care of things. So I just
your suggestion of using the Psalms is a good one, I think, because even though not all of the Psalms are prayers, I mean, the Psalms fall in different categories, but many of them are prayers, and they are wonderful prayers, the ones that are. There have been some times in my life where I couldn't think of anything to pray myself better than just reading the psalm out loud as a prayer, reading it out to God as a prayer. And there were times, like some years ago, I went through a very devastating ordeal where I felt just spiritually hollowed out, and I couldn't even frame words for prayers. And I just spent almost the whole night sometimes just reading out loud some of the psalms that did seem to speak directly to the kind of thing I was going through. It's interesting because when I was young, I never liked the Psalms very much. I remember when I'd hear older people say how much they liked the Psalms, I thought, what? These are boring. I loved God, but I just couldn't get into the Psalms for some reason. And I realized what that reason is. I hadn't suffered. I hadn't suffered yet. Once you've been through some hard times, those Psalms really mean something to you, because David wrote them often in times of great suffering. And he put into words very well what a godly person would want to say to God at times like that. A lot of their complaints. But he complains to God about his circumstances. But then almost always at the end of the psalm, he ends up, you know, his mood's changed, and he's making declarations of how God's going to win the day.
Right, right. He really goes through a kind of a wide gambit of not holding nothing back. If he's upset, he lets it be known, even though God already knows what he's thinking, how he feels and stuff. But that communion between the two, I think that's what God's wanting, more than just a rhetoric or like the Sadducees, the Pharisees did and stuff. And by that, it opened up a lot more closeness, a lot more, like you said, after we go through some things, oh, okay. And then we're not as out to...
You talk to God at a different depth once you've been through the meat grinder
exactly,
a few times. Yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, David, I appreciate that suggestion.
Thank you, sir. Enjoy your show and keep up the good work.
Okay, God bless you. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Same to you. Bye now. All right, our next caller is Orion, the constellation Orion, calling from Moss Landing, California. I didn't know the stars lived in Moss Landing. How you doing, Orion?
Hey, Steve, I'm doing well. Dittos for being young and thinking the Psalms are boring. I'm coming through that myself. I actually really appreciate the response, but yeah, for much of my Christian walk, didn't understand what was so fancy about the Psalms. I'm starting to get it, I guess, a little by little. But
well, you know, if you can still read the Psalms and say I'm not getting anything out of this, maybe you should thank God. You've had an easy life.
Good point, Steve.
Yeah.
So I heard you say something. I think I don't want to misquote you, but I thought I heard you say that Jesus only appeared to the disciples after his resurrection. And
as far as I know, the only exception is James, his brother.
Oh, right. 1 Corinthians 15:6 says that he was buried and resurrected, and then visited Cephas, and then after that. He appeared to 500, more than 500 of the brethren.
Right.
And so I thought that that was.
Well, I believe those 500 were all disciples.
Oh, okay. So you're saying like that. Okay.
Yeah. You thought I meant the apostles?
I thought I meant the apostles.
No. When I said the disciples, I meant his followers.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, well, you're right as usual. You knew that.
I'm not always right, but I'm careful.
No, I didn't say always. As usual, though,
you got
a good streak going. Now, I appreciate that. I wanted to balance comment, and I didn't need to. But thanks for taking my call, Steve.
Well, it's good you called because perhaps others thought the same thing.
Yeah.
So we got that cleared up.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good day.
All right. All right, good talking to you. Yeah, when we think of disciples, sometimes there are times in the Gospels where the word disciples is used and meaning the 12 apostles. But actually, the word disciples was a broader term. Everyone who followed Christ, in fact, everyone who is a true believer in Christ, is called a disciple in Scripture. In the book of Acts, when it talks about the church growing from 3,000 to 5,000 and so forth, it says the number of the disciples increased to 5,000 or something like that. Obviously, it's using the word disciples as a synonym for Christians. And then later, in Acts 11:26, it says, and the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. So, really, the word disciple is a synonym for a Christian or a believer in Christ. Now, there are times in the Gospels, in the early days of Jesus' ministry, that the term disciples is used, and sometimes it appears to mean only the 12. But more often it means a larger number. Once Jesus sent out 70 disciples, two by two, on a mission in Luke chapter 10. And even when he selected his 12 apostles, it says he called his disciples to him, and from them he selected 12, so whom he called apostles. So the word apostle and disciple, sometimes they're used interchangeably, but more often disciple is a broader category. It refers to everyone who's really committed to Jesus in any way as a believer. And the apostles were specially chosen to be the leaders of the movement after his departure. All right. Well, there's a call that's coming in, but I don't see a name for the caller yet, so I can't take that call yet. So maybe I'll take one of these that have been written in to me, and then we'll take that caller once I see a name for him. Somebody wrote in and said, since Pilate is known to have been a heartless tyrant, Are the Gospels accurate in depicting him as acting so uncharacteristically sympathetic toward Jesus? It actually is surprising when you read about the historical Pilate that he was so sympathetic toward Jesus. I mean, it seems like he's always trying to get Jesus off the hook. And the chief priests are there blackmailing him and finally persuading him to deliver him over to them to be crucified. And yet Pilate from history is known to have been bloodthirsty. He had no sympathy for Jews. He had no sympathy for probably anyone but his own career. And for him to show such almost deference to Jesus when Jesus was on trial there, or we might even say it was Pilate that was on trial before Jesus, hard to say. But the point is, it's uncharacteristic. And so the writer of this question asks, is the gospel accurate? In other words, could some people have thought, perhaps the gospel writers were writing sometime much later and they didn't know how evil Pilate was, and so they misrepresented him as being a nice guy when they made up this fictional account of Jesus being tried by Pilate. Well, it's not fictional. And even the gospel writers knew that Pilate was bloodthirsty. For example, in Luke chapter 13, it talks about how some people came to Jesus and told Jesus about some Galileans that Pilate had slaughtered while they were offering their sacrifices in the temple. These unarmed Galilean peasants offering sacrifices in the temple, and Pilate sends his soldiers in just to wipe them out. So the Gospels are aware of this bloodthirsty streak in Pilate. But there's a number of things that made Pilate, I think, act differently toward Jesus. Remember, the Bible says Pilate's own wife sent him a message while he was dealing with Jesus on trial. She sent him a message saying she had been disturbed by a dream that she'd had about Jesus and warned Pilate, have nothing to do with this innocent man. And I have no doubt that Jesus' demeanor commanded respect, too. I think that Pilate was surprised. I think Pilate was taken aback a bit, but that Jesus was not the least bit interested in begging for mercy. Jesus seemed to be more composed than Pilate was. And I think Pilate was just not sure what to make of him. Besides that, Pilate didn't like the Jews, and the Jews wanted Jesus dead. So I have a feeling that Pilate might have just felt like, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. You know, anyone the Jews don't like, I like. And so I think he was really trying to, rub it in the faces of the Jews who were trying to get Jesus crucified, too. So there's a number of factors that could account for Pilate showing uncharacteristic sympathy toward Jesus on this occasion without necessarily suggesting that he was always that way or even very often that way. Let's talk to Garth calling from Oregon City, Oregon. Hi, Garth. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question for you concerning Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. I believe it's verses 38 through 42.
Uh-huh.
I don't have a Bible in front of me. But Jesus is teaching, and he says, you've heard it was said, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. When somebody slaps you in the right cheek, turn to them the other. When someone sues you, wants to take your coat, let them have your cloak also.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. You know, it seems to be a difficult passage because on a couple of different levels. For one, you know, he's referring to the Old Testament scriptures. There's at least three scriptures that talk about eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. And so my question is Jesus changing something, or is he just referring to a teaching that was incorrect and he's trying to correct it? And, how are we to live this out as far as do we just let anybody take anything they want from us? What does it say about justice? Do we ever stand up for ourselves? And,
right.
And what does it say about defending yourself?
Okay, those are some good issues. Stay on the line if you would.
Sure.
Because if I answer one of them, I might forget one of your other questions before I'm
okay.
Done. On the question of an eye for an eye and tooth for tooth, Jesus did not change that law, but he was teaching his disciples how to behave. The law, an eye for an eye for a tooth and a tooth for a tooth, was part of a larger rule that was given to the magistrates when a criminal was brought before them who had injured another party. The judges were to decree what his punishment should be. And in the context of that, several times in Deuteronomy and in Leviticus, it says you shall reward him, if he's knocked a man's eye out, it's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, burn for burn, stripe for stripe, life for life. In other words, the punishment of the criminal should be equivalent to the harm, the irreparable harm that he had done to his victim. And that being so, it was like a exact justice kind of situation. If a person had done an injury that couldn't be redressed, could not be healed or whatever, well, then they just had to be punished in the same way. And I don't know if this was just to level the playing field, level the score, or if it was to provide an incentive for people to avoid injuring other people, just like all criminal penalties are. But it, nonetheless, this eye for eye, tooth for tooth was strictly in the realm of criminal penalties and what the magistrates or the judges were supposed to sentence to violent criminals who'd hurt other people. Jesus said, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye for, and a tooth for a tooth. And what I think he's saying is, you may have gotten the impression, therefore, that if someone hurts you, you should hurt them back. Well, if you're a judge, you have to punish them in some way, and eye for eye, tooth for tooth is a just penalty. But Jesus says, but when someone strikes you, just turn the other cheek. When someone makes you do something you don't want to do, graciously concede to it and go beyond what they require. Now, he's not saying that the law, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, should be abolished. Maybe it should, but he's not saying that. He's not talking about how the magistrates have to stop sentencing criminals. He's talking about how his disciples need to conduct themselves, and they should not take a law like that and use it as some kind of a guide in being vindictive toward people who've hurt them. But rather, his teaching in that section of Matthew 5 is that they should love their enemies as well as their friends. And in that latter section of Matthew 5, he gives many examples of that. You should love even the person who hurts you. Now, that doesn't mean you would never do anything to bring about justice in the situation, but you wouldn't do it out of vindictiveness. You wouldn't do it because you're bearing a grudge and you just, you know, you don't get angry, you get even. That's not the attitude of a Christian. The Christian attitude is, well, I can absorb this injury and, you know, God gives me the grace for it. And this man, you know, I've got to realize this man is a troubled soul. He, you know, anyone who attacks me unprovoked has got problems of his own. Now, if he's out attacking lots of people, then you might call the police, not because you're angry at him, but because he's dangerous. And there is such a thing as Christians standing up for justice. When Jesus talks about going a second mile or turning the other cheek or giving to everyone who asks, or if a person sues you to take your coat, giving your cloak also, these are all instances, I believe, of hyperbole, where he's basically saying you should bend over backward to avoid being vindictive and to avoid being retributive in your attitude toward people who've wronged you. You should be very forgiving. You should be loving toward them. You should even be generous toward them. Now, the reason I say I think it's hyperbole is because I don't think that Jesus was laying down a new law. Actually, the things he taught in that section are found in the Old Testament as well. In the book of Exodus, it says, if you see your enemy's ox has escaped, you take it back to him. Or if you see the man who hates you and his donkey has fallen under its load, you help him up. In other words, do kind things to persons who hate you and who are your enemies. That's in Exodus. That's in the Old Testament. Proverbs says, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. So even the Old Testament teaches the same ethic Jesus did. Jesus was not laying down a new law, but he was trying to illustrate, I think, that the attitude most people have when they're injured is one of wanting to get back. And he's giving examples of how one might have just the opposite attitude. Not only do I not want to injure this person back, but if he gets his jollies hit me on one cheek, maybe I'll let him have the joy of hitting me on the other one too. By the way, in that particular case, that's not talking about a violent assault. Being struck on the right cheek, presumably, would be with the back of the right hand, which is a slap.
Yeah.
You know, if someone's facing you, he can't hit you on the right cheek with his right hand unless he gives you the back of his hand.
Or if he's left-handed. Yeah.
Unless he's left-handed. But the assumption in the Bible is usually that people are right-handed. There are left-handed people in the Bible, but they're usually mentioned as an anomaly. I think Jesus is assuming most people are right-handed. If a guy's facing you and strikes you on the right cheek, presuming he's using his right hand, he's giving you the back of his hand. He's not attacking you to hurt you. He's insulting you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what about...
it's hyperbole, so we don't take it in a wooden, literal sense. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Although we should, you know, when something's a hyperbole, sometimes they say, oh, whew, good, I don't have to do it.
Right.
But, I mean, when Jesus uses hyperbole, as when anyone else does, they're trying to make a point emphatically. I mean, when a mother says to her son, I've told you a million times, take off your muddy shoes before you come in, she's using hyperbole. But she's not using it because she's not trying to communicate something. She's trying to emphasize something. And when Jesus uses hyperbole, he's trying to emphasize something, too. It's just that he's not saying that you have to literally do this very thing every time. But this is the point he wants to get across emphatically, is that you need to have the opposite attitude that you normally have toward people who injure you. Now, when it comes to doing justice, calling the police or whatever, when there's a criminal, you can certainly do that and still love the criminal, because you may also love his other victims. You know, a man who goes about doing violent things, just because he does it to you doesn't mean you have to ignore it. If you're aware that your neighbors are in danger, then there are times when it's the loving thing for you to call the authorities. So a Christian should be concerned about justice, but they should not be concerned about vindictiveness.
What about defending my home or my family?
That is something I believe in, and there's a whole range of Christian attitudes about self-defense. I would recommend, since I'm almost out of time here, in fact, you're going to hear the music in just a few minutes, I would suggest that you read an article I wrote that's at my website called, I think it's called, The Christian's Use of Forcible Resistance. It's at my website, thenarrowpath.com,
uh-huh.
And there's a link that says topical articles. And I actually, a pastor from this town wrote to me once many years ago asking me about that, and I wrote the article in response to him. And it's at the website under topical articles.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, Garth, thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. There's one other call I'd like to get in, although we only have about a minute or so, I'm afraid. I don't know if that's enough for you, George, but welcome from Las Vegas. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Oh, thank you, Greg. I enjoy your show. Greg, my question is, you were talking to a gentleman, and you used the analogy of God being a chess master, and you said he does not know what move you're going to make. And I wanted to know, are you of that theological ilk that don't believe in the omniscience of God?
I'm glad you asked me that, because I'm not of that ilk. That ilk is called the openness theology.
That's
right. And I'm not openness. When I said the chess master doesn't know, I didn't mean that God doesn't know. Oh. I'm saying that in the analogy of a chess master who's playing several different opponents,
yeah,
that chess master doesn't know what they're going to do, but it doesn't matter. He can beat them anyway. Of course, I do believe that God knows what we're going to do. But the point I was making is that we can do almost anything we want to do, and God can still win the day.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to clear that up, because I know that the foreknowledge does not necessarily dictate determinism.
That's true. That's true. I am Arminian, so
yeah.
So I believe in foreknowledge. Yeah.
And that to me means you may be a little semi-Pelagian also, which, you know.
Well, could be. Yeah. Calvinists use the term semi-Pelagian as a real insult. But if we're only semi-Pelagian, then we're not all the way to Pelagianism.
That's why I'm not insulting you completely.
Yeah, I know.
But I enjoy your show every day.
Okay, George, I appreciate your call.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks
now.
For making it. Bye now.
Bye now.
You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday. Of course, this Friday is going to be Christmas, so we'll be playing a recorded program. But for the rest of the week, apart from Friday, we'll be doing what we always do, live broadcasting. So you can call in if you have questions or disagreements, and we can talk about them here for an hour each day. Been doing this for over 12 years now. And you notice we don't have any commercial breaks, and we don't have any sponsors. If you go to our website, you won't find a thing for sale. Nor do we sell anything on the air. We pay for the time on the radio, which is pretty expensive, just with, to tell you the truth, just trust God to bring it in, but it comes in largely from listeners. And if you're a listener and would like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. If you weren't able to write that down and you want that address, it can be found with many other things at our website. Our website has a lot of free resources, hundreds, 900 or more, MP3 files you can download for free. Also, those topical articles I mentioned. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.